diabetes has a way of sneaking up on you. I was diagnosed at 7 years old with no family history, and as I often lament, before the diabetes online community began. I was restrained by hospital staff during my insulin injections. My autonomy was stripped from me, and I was confused by my new reality. I was woken up frequently during the night for painful finger sticks. There was little compassion and empathy in my hospital room, and I distinctly remember a lack of communication.
Hi everyone, this is Joe Bianco, co-producer and co-host of the Defining Moments podcast. The American Diabetes Association estimates that 38.4 million Americans, that's about 11.6% of the population, are living with some form of diabetes. Of those, more than 2 million have type 1 diabetes. While much of the national dialogue has focused on the growing prevalence of type 2 diabetes, less attention is given to the approximately 2 million people, which includes more than 300,000 children and adolescents in the U.S. living with type 1. The quote that opened this episode came from today's guest, Dr. Allison Hughes, who read passages from her recent health communication article, Diabetes, Insulin, and Politics, 28 Years of Stigma, Innovation, and Ableism. You can find a link to the article on the Defining Moments Facebook page. So today I'm thrilled to introduce you to my colleague and friend, Dr. Allie Hughes. She's going to shed light on the lived experiences of persons with type 1 diabetes. Dr. Hughes is a health psychologist by training and assistant professor of primary care at the Ohio University Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine. Her research focuses on psychosocial challenges of diabetes management. Current projects examine the intersection of diabetes technology, vision loss, and living with diabetes. A passionate and tireless advocate for the type 1 diabetes community and persons with disabilities, Dr. Hughes uses her research and personal experience to raise awareness of the surprising social and political barriers that people must negotiate as part of the everyday management of their diabetes. Her work has informed policy and led to the creation of guidelines and competencies designed to improve the lived experience of persons with diabetes and disability. And while she takes diabetes care and advocacy very seriously, you'll be delighted to know that Dr. Hughes does not take herself seriously at all. In fact, in the course of this episode, we'll not only cover health disparities, social stigma, and medical trauma associated with type 1 diabetes, but we'll also explore the role that humor plays in promoting health and wellness amid chronic illness. Allie, I am so excited to have this conversation with you. Welcome to the Defining Moments podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So, Allie, for our listeners who may not know, please tell us about type 1 diabetes, what it is and how it differs from type 2.
So type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune condition. It's been diagnosed across the lifespan. So when I was first diagnosed, I only heard about children having it. But now that we are collecting more data on it and population health and epidemiology wise, we're finding out that older adults are also getting it, and I've heard cases of folks in their 60s, 70s, and 80s being diagnosed with type 1. So there's also not very much of a genetic component to it as well. Majority of people diagnosed with type 1 are not do not have anyone in their family with type 1, so they're the first, which can be really harmful and really lonely, but in isolating. So what is the difference from type 1 and type 2? Type 2 is largely genetic, largely blamed on and diet and exercise, but really there's such a large genetic component that we really can't forget about that. So folks with type 1, as soon as they're diagnosed, need insulin. Folks with type 2, they can also possibly need insulin immediately, but often they can have oral medications, and that is their treatment.
It's interesting that you mentioned the genetic component of type 2, which is not something that we hear. We hear that type 2 is caused by, you know, poor adherence to lifestyle and diet. And so, yeah, that's a very interesting and I think important point.
Well, it builds on the blame and shame game is what I call it. And that's what the you know, it's a colloquial term, but it's stigma, it's bias, it's saying you did this to yourself, it's your fault. And then when you have diabetes complications, whether it be type 1 or type 2, it's your fault, you did that to yourself. And it's just simply not true. It's genetics, it's because of diabetes.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a great clarification. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So continuing along these lines, in your Defining Moments article, you paint a really vivid and kind of surprising picture of the trauma associated with an onset of type 1. Now, for you, you were 7 years old, although as you've said, you can be diagnosed with type 1 at any point throughout the lifespan, not just during childhood. But can you tell listeners a little more about that moment of initial diagnosis and things that you and maybe other persons with type 1 have experienced when the diagnosis kind of rears its head?
Yeah, so thankfully my mom caught the symptoms very early, which likely prevented a very serious life-threatening situation. So I was sleepwalking and I was losing weight. I was drinking a lot of fluids, but still just couldn't quench my thirst. And I had just started first grade a couple months before, and we had just moved, and it was just a lot of changes that were happening. So I'm sure my parents were also, I can think of this as an adult now, they were probably like just settling in, figuring things out, and then all of a sudden their kid was sick, and they had to take me to the pediatrician. So my mom took me, and she really probably saved my life because she advocated so hard for me to get tested back in 1995 before she really had any exposure to type 1. She's an amazing type 1 advocate now, but that was before she really knew. What I did not include in the article is she actually was babysitting in the house that we had moved from in our previous neighborhood when I was a child. She was babysitting someone that had type 1. And so I think that was kind of, she probably just caught the sign so early because, thank God, she knew someone and was able to take me to the pediatrician and get it tested out.
And when she initially took you and she told the pediatrician, this is likely type 1, what was the response?
He was very dismissive. I remember being there in that room, but I really can't see anyone, if that makes sense. It's like the memory of like this yellow, gross clinic room back in 1995. And I remember my mom pushing and saying, no, really, and him just being like, no. And then I remember having to pee in a cup, and the rest is history. Mm. So,
well, it was great that you had her there with her knowledge and her advocacy.
Yeah, no kidding.
And advocacy has been a constant theme ever since, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay, so I've read that persons with diabetes, any kind of diabetes, make a few dozen health-related decisions in a single day. And that's only one aspect of living with this condition. What else do persons with type 1 experience? Can you walk us through sort of a typical day involving all the different things that go into, you know, diabetes care?
Yeah, so diabetes is really a 24/7 disease. That's something I always talk about in my presentations. It's a 24/7 disease, a 24/7 job. So the minute I wake up, I am thinking about diabetes. I'm seeing what my blood sugar is. I'm seeing if I need to make any corrections to my blood sugar. You know, if there's anything alarming going on, like if my blood sugar is high, do I need to change my pump site? You know, is it accurate? Is my CGM, my continuous glucose monitor, is it reading accurately? There's so many pieces, and that's literally like the first minute of my day. Mm. That's how I start. And then, of course, I get some coffee and get to go about my day, check my emails and things, but every moment is really, have I eaten enough? Have I exercised enough? Have I, you know, really checked in with my body enough to make sure that I am, you know, on the right track for myself and the numbers that I feel best at? Mm-hmm. And so it's a constant juggling act to make sure that, like, if I walk just a little further from my car, is that going to make my blood sugar low? Or I just came back from New Orleans and it was very hot there, so my blood sugars were high because of the heat, and I struggled with my pump sites because of the heat. So it's stuff like that where most people are not thinking about that in New Orleans, thankfully. So,
yeah, most people, when they get up, are thinking and starting with that cup of coffee, right? They haven't put in a 9-to-5 job already.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Yeah, because overnight as well, it can be, do I have too much insulin that's active in my body and I need to worry about a low overnight? Am I running high? You know, I will get alerts all through the night if my blood sugar is high or low. And that's obviously very, very disruptive for sleep. So I have to make sure that I'm just keeping myself, it's almost like a homeostasis thing of just keeping myself right there, or almost with the caffeine, just enough caffeine, right? You know, you got to find that perfect medium, that perfect balance.
Is it more or less predictable, or are there times where, you know, you're doing everything according to the plan, and just for whatever reason, you know, you're experiencing fluctuations and all that? Is it predictable, or?
The minute you think it's predictable, it just completely becomes unpredictable. So there's something that we say in the diabetes community that you can eat the same meal at the same time 2 days in a row, take the same amount of insulin, and have completely different outcomes, whether being high, low, or target range blood sugar. And so that's really true. I mean, I can tell you just from, you know, decades of being on this earth and having diabetes and dosing insulin that it's, you just never know what's going to happen. You just have to be on your toes.
So it requires you throughout your day to be fairly hypervigilant.
Yep, exactly. Especially driving or you know, anything like that. You just have to be really, really careful.
So he knows we haven't even gotten to work yet where you start your work day, right?
Yeah, right.
Are there ways that, you know, all of this interfere or at least make it harder for you, your experience of just going through a typical work day? You know, what's that experience like for you?
Yeah. So one balancing thing that I have is for low blood sugar, I have a snack drawer in my desk, and then I have spare pump sites, so spare needles, alcohol swabs, all those things if I need to change that out quickly throughout the day so I don't miss a beat in a meeting. So everything is located very close to me. And that's one brilliant thing also about working at home is like I'm close to a fridge. Anything I need is there. And so that's one thing I deeply appreciate about mostly remote work.
I can see how remote work would be especially helpful and could be life-saving in some ways.
You never forget anything at home because you're already home.
Right.
Yep.
Good. Thank you. So managing and dealing with type 1 is a full-time job, right? But it can't be your only job because insulin is very expensive and insulin is also non-negotiable. You have to have insulin, right? So can you talk a bit about the politics of insulin access and the additional hurdles that people have to go through to get insulin?
So back in the day when I was first diagnosed, the thing that my family and I struggled to afford was actually checking my blood sugar. And that was because the test strips, as they were called back then, were very hard, or even chem strips to really take it back in the day, showing I'm a diabetes dinosaur. All these terms have changed now. But those were really, really expensive. Oh my goodness, those were expensive. And so we could afford insulin because it was like $25 a bottle. But those test strips, as they were called, were so expensive. I remember my parents being really stressed out about that because sometimes a strip failed and we didn't get enough blood on it or it timed out. And so it was a very, very big deal because it needed so much blood as well. Nowadays, way less blood. We're living in the innovation age. But back in the day, my dad would call it milking my finger because he was just trying to get my little hand to like produce some blood. And he was really good at that. But yeah, so that's something I definitely think about is the cost and how it's changed. So since I was diagnosed, the price of insulin has gone up over 1,200%. And the reason for that is really a lack of policy, a lack of governance, and really as much as we push as advocates and as much as we push at the state level and the federal level, we just can't get protection for people that need insulin every day. It's been really, really hard to afford those things. And one thing that I do is I support Mutual Aid Diabetes and T1 International and all these other mutual aid groups where folks can literally go online and say, I'm on my last bottle of insulin. Mm-hmm. And isn't there anyone in my area that can send it to me, or I can meet up with you at the local restaurant or something like that. And I've done that several times to help people get what they need, or for myself, get what I need. And there's no reason that that should ever happen in healthcare. First off, it's a prescription drug, right? But second, without insulin, very quickly, we begin to have complications and, you know, face mortality. So there's really no reason for that. So the pricing around it has become political. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, every political candidate, especially on the federal level that comes out, and even governors as well, they talk about the price of insulin and they say, I'm going to lower it. How are you going to lower it if you don't put laws into place, right? And you can't get that federal foothold. So I have a lot to say about that. But insulin's so, so expensive. And I will say too, insulin's expensive, but also the ways to take insulin's very expensive. So diabetes technology, for example, my insulin pump is thousands of dollars. So when I go to legislators, I have them literally look and sometimes even hold my insulin pump and I say, this is as much as a used car. What am I going to do about this if I lose my job or I lose my insurance? And one really great advocate in the community, Laura Marsden, who's an attorney in D.C., she talks about that she's always just like one step away from being laid off and being without insurance and being closer to death. And that's part of her message and her advocacy that's led her around Capitol Hill. And that's truly the reality that we all live in.
Hmm. It's really shocking that a life-saving medication, the price skyrocketed to that extent. And then it's also very heartening to hear that there are workarounds and other ways that the community takes care of itself. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about the program you described of, you know, checking in about shortages of, and exchanging?
Recently, I was looking for insulin for a friend in Ohio, and I posted on Reddit, and I said, who's in the area, and who has this specific type of insulin? And within 24 hours, I had a couple months' worth of insulin for them, free.
Wow.
And it, believe it or not, it was all moms, where their kids were at college, and they just said, hey, we've got insulin that's going to expire. If we don't use it, take it. Because we're so used to having medical waste, right, and having things expire. And so it was amazing. I mean, I don't even know how many miles we drove that day, me and my husband, just going all over Ohio trying to get insulin for this person. But it's things like that. It's just – it's almost someone in the community calls it a twilight bark, like 101 Dalmatians. And she'll just say, hey, twilight bark, someone's pump broke, they need this type of insulin, blah, blah, blah. And no kidding, every time they're covered. It's such a strong community.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll hear more about the community and the creative kind of ways in which people have mobilized to overcome or circumvent some of these unnecessary barriers placed.
You know what? I want to say, though, Joe, taking back what I just said of every time they're covered.
Yeah.
Most of the time they're covered.
Yeah.
We have great support, but at the same time, it's still a life-saving drug that we shouldn't have to fight so hard for. So I just want to say, we do get coverage, but it's like a Band-Aid for like maybe like a suture problem, you know, or like a surgical situation. And so there are many folks that are truly rationing their insulin and truly taking as little as they need per day just because that's all they can afford. And then that promotes complications.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. Going back to your original point, though, it should never be this difficult.
No.
It should never be this difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thank you for that, that clarification. I think this is a nice point to segue into some of your work as a disabilities advocate. So your experiences as a type 1 patient have catalyzed your career as a diabetes researcher and a disabilities advocate. So actually, let's start with your research. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of your research on diabetes, what you've some of the broad strokes of what you've found?
Yeah, so it really started around my dissertation, and I started really getting into methodology and really geeking out about research methods and stats and things. And then I was like, oh, I could build a scale to get at health information seeking in the diabetes community, because many people will go on there, especially the beginning COVID times, right when we were having vaccine availability. Should I get a COVID vaccine? I have type 1. I've had it for X amount of years. Should I get a COVID vaccine? I have type 2. I mean, the list goes on. And which one should I get? And, you know, there was a lot of conversation going on there. And so I just really developed a scale and used that for my dissertation, published more about that scale recently. And then I started doing research with pharmaceutical companies through a nonprofit in Boston called T1D Exchange. And no matter what the objectives and research questions were, believe it or not, every hypothesis, every single one, led to me publishing about the cost of insulin and the burden and diabetes distress that caregivers had, that people with diabetes had. It was like, it didn't matter what we were talking about. It always took a turn to that. And I was like, wait a second, am I a health equity researcher? Like, I didn't even realize it, that I was wearing that hat. And I'd been wearing it for a long time, apparently. So then I was like, well, I might as well, you know, as I moved on to Ohio University's med school, I was like, you know, I should probably just call myself a health equity researcher and start actually claiming what I've been doing all these years. And so then that led to some of my favorite work that I've done is my disability work, where I qualitatively detected the intersectional diabetes distress experienced by folks with vision loss and diabetes, and how hard that is to navigate that in the medical setting, at home, with family, day to day, as I said, 24/7 job with diabetes. But also all this work around just truly talking about the basics of disability and reducing ableism and stigma. It's just, no one has talked about it quite the frame that I and lens that I present. And I love that because I bring my lived experience. Plus, I have an amazing community advisory board of blind folks and low vision folks that are using diabetes technology. And they really tell me what to research. They're doing my job for me, right? They're like, wait, wait, wait. We need to know more about us and more about our doctors. And I'm like, great, let's do it and collaborate. So I've been really, really happy with the way that's been working out very recently. It's just almost like a kismet thing. It's been really nice.
That's great. And yeah. I have to say, like, whenever we talk about your work on disability advocacy or creating programs or doing research and learning more about the lived experiences of people like you just described, you light up. It's like you look so happy. It's like you found your place.
So I found my people. Yeah. And it's like, it's just all word of mouth, too, where it's like, oh, have you heard about this task force? And, oh, what about this? And it, like, a lot of the conversations I have all live on listservs or, like, this very basic sort of thing. And I love it. I really feel like it's very cutting edge and innovative. And it's right where I didn't know I needed to be or wanted to be. But then here I am. It's a lot of fun. Yeah.
It's great. So. Many defining moments in today's episode. Right? Well, that's great. And it sounds like really all roads lead back to insulin, and anything that leads back to insulin leads to advocacy, right?
Yeah. I want to say, too, I just gave a presentation on Sunday around health equity and diabetes technology, and my community advisory board had a recorded presentation where it was a bunch of folks with vision loss and diabetes using diabetes technology, talking about all of the workarounds they have to go through in hacks just to use the same pump that I use. And it was really fascinating. And I am just such a broken record at these presentations, because I'll just say it like 10 times, no kidding, in 10 minutes. That's a workaround. That's a hack. We need universal design. We need, you know, accessibility. And then still someone in the audience stood up from one of the companies and said, oh, well, if you just print off this label and stick this on your pump and then it'll have tactile buttons. And I said, that's a workaround. And that's someone that has to pay out of pocket for tactile buttons for their insulin pump that, for the record, that would just unlock it. It still doesn't get you to take an insulin. So it's stuff like that where I feel like I'm constantly kind of like, I don't know, knocking at that door or trying to break it down of just like that basic embedded, but look, we're helping. It's like, that's not help. That's extra work.
Right.
You know, so I just wanted to add that as well.
Right. So it sounds like a lot of the user experience of these devices doesn't get back to the people who design them.
Yeah. So we have, so my community advisory board, the Accessible Insulin Pump Task Force, they have connections with a lot of these companies. But the problem is getting it through FDA, and also the, you know, I'm sure the 20 levels of bureaucracy that you have to get through just to make one small change on a medical device. Gotcha. So we just keep pushing and meeting with people and trying to get the word out. And I think it's not even that we're talking to the pharmaceutical companies that I think is most important, but it's the nurses that come up to me and the diabetes care and education specialists that come up to me and say, I have a blind patient and I need your help. Mm-hmm. And then I give them my card and then we talk. It's that kind of stuff where I'm like, okay, that feels like I'm really fulfilling something mm-hmm. there. And even if other people don't like really, you know, understand what I'm talking about or don't let it sink in, if I have one person that, you know, made that connection with me and I can help that one person that's blind with diabetes, then I'm doing my job.
Absolutely.
I learned about this in grad school, the clinical significance versus statistical significance. I think about it all the time. I think about it all the time and I talk about it with my classmates still. And I never thought this would stick with me so hard, but I'm really at that point where I'm like, if I make one difference that's clinically significant, that's so much more important than a research significance of having a big paper and getting it published. Like, I want to help someone on that level.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think about that a lot, too. My background was in psychotherapy research, right? Mm-hmm. So what's efficacious? What's effective?
Yes.
And is it effective just because we have a nice confidence interval?
Right.
Or is it effective because there's actually on-the-ground clinical
exactly.
significance? So really important. And it sounds like, you know, to affect some sort of clinical significance, you find the people who are out there in the trenches. You mentioned yeah. nurses, you mentioned diabetes educators, right? People who are really there, who get it and want to do that translational work of, you know, bridging research into actual pragmatic use for people living with type 1.
Yeah, I call those folks the boots on the ground. So I get, like I said, I get my comfy office at home. I got my snack drawer. They're out there, boots on the ground, helping people get medication and fighting for coverage and truly health equity heroes. And then I get to just write about it.
So a little shout out at this point for the health equity heroes out
Seriously.
There. We appreciate you.
Seriously, we all need them.
There are many of you out there. We appreciate you. Hi, folks. This is Joe breaking in for just a second. We've been talking to Dr. Allison Hughes about the social and political complexities of living with type 1 diabetes. For your convenience, we have placed links to recently published articles in health communication on our Facebook page. Okay, back to the conversation. You talk in the article, and we've talked about this as well, about the importance of words.
Mm-hmm.
And labels, and the way we wittingly or unwittingly narrate
right.
a healthcare experience.
Yep.
So how can the healthcare industry and even popular culture use words that empower rather than create stigma for people with type 1 or any kind of diabetes, actually?
Mm-hmm. So I've learned a lot from the leading clinicians out there in diabetes about using strengths-based care and not just focusing on like the negatives. So, oh, look at your blood sugars, or oh, you gain weight, or like, nobody wants to hear that. That's not empowering. It's strengths-based care is like, oh, look at, you really knocked it out on last Friday. How did you manage that? Look how well you did after walking your dog or anything like that. And then look what your blood sugar was. Like that kind of like you're doing a great job. We all need to hear that as humans in clinic or out. And so I love strength-based care. That's one of my favorite things. But also there's been some national and international language guidelines and language recommendations specifically for diabetes. And it is around thinking about the disability community, but also personality and also how we are perceived and how we perceive ourselves. So there's this piece to it of saying, if I can call myself identity first or person first language. So I used to identify as someone who's a diabetic. I used to say, hi, I'm Allie, I'm a diabetic. That was part of the whole loop of my first breath to people, partly self-preservation, right? Where I was like, you need to know just in case. And I said, okay, you're going to learn. And just in case I need a juice or something like that. But there's also person first, which is saying person with diabetes or person with a disability. And so there's some research recently in the last decade or so that came out saying that there's medical, specifically health outcomes that are impacted by the language we use, even based in a randomized control trial. So controlling as much as we can these variables, we can say that people with diabetes, when they're spoken to in clinic with negative words such as burden, diabetic, anything like that, adherence even can be a trigger for some folks. And compliance, don't get me started on being called non-compliant. Don't get me started. It's happened, and I had to take someone to school about it. So
it's less, right? I'm hoping. I've noticed it's
yes,
used less.
Yes,
but
it's
yeah.
definitely less. But, I mean, for there were, ICD-9 and codes that were just kind of like calling people out. I'm like, dang, if you read your my chart, that's just going to feel like a dagger in your back saying, I work 24/7 job plus a real job, right? And like where I'm actually getting paid, with diabetes, you don't get any time off, but then I'm not doing well at it. And you're saying I'm not even, adhering air quotes to it. Yeah. So we've tried to throw those words out. Instead, we try to focus on identity first. If people want to call themselves diabetic, fantastic. Do it. I'm not going to call you that. And in clinic, we say clinicians should not, because there's literally a randomized control trial showing that folks that were randomized to the condition of having that negative language actually had higher blood sugars. Mm-hmm. And so we were like, enough is enough. We have to throw this out. And I'm really, really proud of that, because I think we're all learning. And I think it's like a developing story, really, of like what this language looks like. But these guidelines came out that are just so fantastic that let us say, oh, I don't have to talk to you for hours to get you to understand. I can just hand you this pamphlet or like hand you this article. So it's been really fantastic to see.
No, that's fantastic. And it's to your point about language evolving and keeping up. So not to date myself as older, but, compliance was everywhere when I was starting out. And it always just kind of set my teeth on edge. Mm-hmm. So adherence became the word we used. And now adherence is really also considered like kind of the same thing, so what words would you suggest in when talking to someone about their choice to adopt a medication or a treatment plan? Yeah. How would you describe that?
So we try to use words like engagement.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll say someone who's less engaged or more engaged and things like that. So obviously, because of the work I do and because of being in this game for so long, the diabetes game, I'm seen as pretty hypervigilant and highly engaged. But someone who's like, hey, I don't really want to take my medication, or maybe has barriers specifically to taking it, there's a lot that wraps that up, but maybe less engaged could be something. There's a fantastic paper from Dr. Jane Dickinson, and who's the outgoing president for ADCES right now. She's lovely. And it gives all the guidelines, a fantastic table one of what we should use instead of.
Nice.
So side by side. Nice. And I think engagement's my favorite thing for the research, because that way I'm not stepping on any toes and people can use the language they want to use. But when it's forward facing sort of things, I really try to stick to the guidelines and make sure it's right.
I like that a lot, because engagement can also be a factor of whether or not you agree with a plan or it's feasible for you. And so if you're not as engaged, it could be because you can't afford some of the things, or maybe you don't understand the math that goes into these complicated carb counts. It adds a layer of dignity and also a benefit of the doubt.
As it should be. There's so many more reasons. It's the thing that also, as a stats nerd, I'll say it's falsely dichotomizing. So we can't just put these things into two groups and say compliant, non-compliant, right? It's like it's fluid, it's linear. And so instead of grouping them, we have to say, hey, we got to take a step back and say there are other words to use here. And we can't just – it's the in-group, out-group.
Yeah.
And we can't be doing stuff like that when it comes to healthcare.
Absolutely. Oh, that was great. Okay. And so then we've also talked about, we've talked about ways too, when we talk about language, that humor is used inappropriately in seemingly innocuous ways in popular culture, on TV shows, someone saying, oh, after that meal, I'm going to need insulin, right? And these little seemingly harmless things actually are not funny to most people, but not funny, especially to people with diabetes. And in your article, you talk about how that perpetuates stigma.
Because the problem is that might be the only way that people see information about diabetes is through the humor. And then it's essentially health misinformation. Oh, I watched this and this comedian and, oh, they said this about diabetes. And then it kind of gets embedded in there in your brain. And you're like, oh, is that accurate? Because then I'm going to start perpetuating that as well. And that's really how these things are all based. It's just like, you know, source issues. And so that's something that I try to fight is online is, you know, health misinformation. Because at the end of the day, that's part of the health equity bit. Like, we should all have access to accurate health information and be talked to in a respectful manner. And all those things that language guidelines and these strengths-based care guidelines say. And so that's really what I think about. I will laugh at, you know, some humor just like the next person. But when it's something so – I just feel like the diabetes humor is lazy now because it's not unique anymore. Everybody said it. So when you write, you know, for a screenplay and you make a diabetes joke, it's just like, is that funny? It's not funny. It's lazy. It's been going on for decades. So I'm ready for people to move on and joke about other things, not other conditions per se, but just about other things. And so that's why I quote one of my husband and I's favorite shows in the whole world is Bob's Burgers. And I was so pleasantly surprised when they made the diabetes joke, when Bob made the joke, and then Mickey says, no, no, wait, that's a terrible disease. You can't make that joke. I was like, yes. I was like, this cartoon really came through for people with diabetes. And so, yeah, big fan of Bob's.
Yeah, so these shows can actually be a powerful way to advocate without even knowing, right? And to reach people, have them feel heard, and maybe teach others something.
Because that's a testament to the time that we're in of humor, of saying, no, 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 that's not good. We shouldn't say that. And that's what I love about that. It's like a 15-second thing maybe. And it just impacted me so much because I was so ready to be let down. I was like, I'm going to be let down by this show. You know, such a great show, favorite show. And then it didn't let me down. I was like, yes.
It had
advocacy.
Your back.
Yes. Yes.
It had your back. There should be more of that.
I know. I know.
No, that's great. And you certainly use humor all the time.
I do.
Our listeners will probably be tickled to know that we had to meet for coffee before recording so that we wouldn't get the giggles. We wanted to get a lot of the giggles out.
Yep. You did call the meeting Giggle Fest.
Outlook, I did. I may have done that. But so there's no shortage of humor in Allie's everyday life. And it's one of the things I think I most admire is how, knowing everything that, you know, you're dealing with and the severity of the issues that you advocate for and the experiences that you also have this way of making lots of people just laugh, like really deep belly laughs. And that to me is therapeutic. So
yeah, I completely agree. I mean, obviously humor is my coping mechanism and it has been for a long time. And I also love making people laugh and it's just been really rewarding.
Good. Well, I certainly appreciate it. Let's talk a little bit about the role that the online diabetes community played for you, because you were diagnosed before the internet, sort of.
Before Google.
Before Google, really. Okay. Yeah. I'm sure there was Netscape or something.
There was, yeah.
On a DOS machine or...
Yeah.
I'm teasing you.
I know, but still. Yeah. You know, I mean, I remember using Napster, and I'm a very early user of eBay. I'm still very good at it, by the way.
Good.
So yeah.
That's
good. I'll outbid anyone.
Well, you're more advanced than I was.
I was bored. I was a bored farm kid, you know.
But you talked about, though, like, as you're growing up with diabetes, the power of the internet, because you came across blogs, you came across different people, you came across social media. That was validating. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I've always loved gaining new information, which is very on brand for me. My mom really made sure that I grew up in libraries. And even I remember as a kid, anytime I was in the middle of a transition or unsure of something, I would literally just go to the library and just walk to the library. That was my, and still is one of my, it's like a home for me, no matter where I am. Like if I'm on a trip, sometimes I'll go to a library on the trip just to like, I just love it. Mm-hmm. I just love it so much. And so for me, with gaining information, I was just furiously reading all the time. And then all of a sudden, internet blogging started. And I was like, oh my God, people are sharing their stories. This is brilliant. It was like having a view into someone's diary or journal. And then all of a sudden, I found Carrie Sparling. I still don't know how. I truly don't know how, but she was one of the first type 1 diabetes bloggers out there who really told a very real story and didn't, you know, add any detail that was extraneous. I love the way that she writes, where she just, something that I say is like, it's all meat, no fat sort of things, where you're just like, God, that's solid. I wish I could write like that. And that's just what she does. And so she talked about, hey, I'm getting married. And then I was like, hey, I'm trying to have kids. And then she talked about complications with diabetes, you know, all the things that she's been through, and just very real about stress. But also she's a fellow cat lover, you know, she would talk about coffee and things like that. And what's beautiful too is she was diagnosed around the same age as me, but about 10 years before. So it was almost like this mysticism of like, oh my God, I'm looking into the future and she's okay. You know, and that's what I really love, because in Pete's care, sometimes there's this really scary thing of like, if you don't take care of yourself, this message is horrible. And a lot of people have heard this, especially as kiddos. And even now, horribly as adults, if you don't take care of yourself, you're going to go blind. And these horrible things, who says that to a kid, first off? Who says that to another human being, even adults? And so for me, seeing her, I was like, oh, I can handle this. You know, and it was before I really, you know, had like all my diabetes besties that I have now that I can literally message in the middle of the night if I'm like, oh, something's wrong with my insulin pump, how do I fix it, or anything like that. Like, she was the first, and it wasn't like we were engaging with each other online. It was really like this passive sort of engagement where she would just put it up and then I'd read it, and then it just made me feel so good.
Yeah. Sounds really therapeutic, because I would imagine how easy it is to feel completely alone.
Yeah, it's really, really tough, because especially with the symptoms that come with blood sugar fluctuations. So low blood sugar / hypoglycemia can feel sometimes like a panic attack. It can feel like very anxiety driven. So sometimes I'm like, wait, am I being anxious, or am I having a low blood sugar? And then I have to check my CGM. And then high blood sugar, you can feel really sick. And just like, if it's very high, you can feel like flu symptoms sort of thing, because you're very dehydrated, you get achy. It's very frustrating because you can't work. And obviously physical activity is hard. So, you know, just seeing that in someone else and talking so openly about it, it was just, oh my God, Carrie's such a breath of fresh air.
That's great. And is she still actively blogging?
So she has published, I think, 2 books now. I think that's correct. And every once in a while, she does a blog update. And I think she wanted to, my understanding is she kind of, what she posted online was like, she wanted to step back a little bit and, you know, do the mom thing and take a break from blogging. And I love that. Yeah. You know, it's like, it's also cool to be like, it's not just defining her all the time, just her and her blog. And right. I love that she stepped away from it. Because like in my world, and in many, many people I work with and know and love, you know, we have diabetes, and then we chose diabetes as our career. So we're just like diabetes on top of diabetes, right? Diabetes squared, you know? And so we're just out there doing the thing. And often when I have students come to me, or mentees and or mentees come to me and say, hey, I'm thinking about choosing diabetes as my profession, the first thing I talk about to them is burnout and how to pivot if you get burnout. And I literally had that conversation over the weekend with a student of just like, hey, here's what to do, you know. And that's a conversation I think we all need to hear sometimes, even when it's not like for myself disease-based, but, you know, for others, like you need to know when you can just like take a step back and not have to focus on the same thing all the time. It can be very, very draining.
And then what's nice about that is you're now the Carrie Sparling for another generation.
Oh, you're going to make me cry. I love that. I didn't even think about that. But the thing I think about with, you know, after going through a lot of therapy. The thing that I think about now is like my inner child and me being that person for my inner child. And so when I see like the kids at camp, the camp we have here is amazing for kids with type 1. When I see those kids, I'm like, all right, I know exactly how to act with these kids and I know what I needed and I know what they need because I'm just so honed in.
You get it.
And it's been so fulfilling. And we, me and a few other volunteers from that camp say it's our favorite time of year, but it's our most exhausted. We're all just kind of like, you know, wake me up if I start snoring sort of stuff because you're just like so exhausted at the end of the day and end of the week with the kids from camp. But it's just so fulfilling to be there for them and knowing that that's their time to be around everybody that gets it.
Yeah.
Beeping like they're beeping, taking the same stinky insulin, you know, just like dealing with the same things. It's so beautiful.
Not having to hide, you know, their equipment and stuff.
Yeah.
I've heard really great things about diabetes camps. Or a friend of my daughter's has Crohn's, and when she found a camp when she was a teenager that was devoted to kids who had Crohn's, I mean, it was so freeing for her.
Yeah, because it is a – I do think it's a huge difference from reading about it online and then having it in person because, like, yes, of course there's those benefits of seeing these blogs and even now TikToks and everything around, like, oh, my God, look at all this great content from people with diabetes and parents of kids with diabetes and all these things. But then to have it in person and literally hear that beep, you're like, oh, that person has the same device as me and they get it, you know.
That's fantastic. And that's a good segue also into talking about advice you may have or resources you may have for, let's say, parents whose children are diagnosed, newly diagnosed with type 1.
Yeah. So just a little plug for a fantastic program for parents and kiddos and really anyone of any age, but it's largely focused for the younger side of things, is Friends for Life that is put on by children with diabetes. It's basically a camp in Orlando. There's also one in New York, in Indiana, and it's for the whole family. They carb count everything at the buffet for you. They have gluten-free food. I mean, it's just fantastic. It's a totally impressive environment where you can drop your kids off and they can go have the care they need. And then you as a parent can go talk to someone like myself, a psychologist, and learn about, you know, strengths and weaknesses and what you need to do for your family to support them. I love it. It's just a fantastic thing. And like I said, I will be there in Orlando 2025. Come see me if anyone's able to. But you know, it's just one of the most fantastic things to be with others like you, especially for parents, because we know, not to be too researchy, too sciencey, but you know, caregiver burden is a huge thing, a huge thing. And the thing I always tell people, which is also pretty dated at this point because everybody says it, but it's like, you got to put on your mask first. Like, how are you going to help someone else if you're exhausted and you're always checking CGM alarms and you're always, always going, right? And so that's one benefit of camp. That's one benefit of Friends for Life, hosted by children with diabetes. You can just go do your thing and someone else is worrying about the blood sugars. And I really, really recommend that for people, no matter what age, because there will be people my age and older there that are also looking for community. And so I had a talk on this actually for parents. Gosh, it must have been almost a year ago now. And I had people coming up to me and they, after my talk to parents, and they were just like, I just want to make sure I'm not ruining my kid. I'm like, of course you're not ruining your kid. You're at a conference to learn more about helping your kiddo, right? And so it's that kind of also hypervigilance, right? Which is just, you need that with diabetes. And yeah, I think also we need to all let ourselves off the hook about diabetes. But talking to others like you, whether you are a parent, grandparent, sibling, anything, I think it's just so helpful to get that social support.
Yeah, absolutely. It can really make or break an experience
truly,
for someone.
Truly, yeah.
Thank you for that. I would like to end today with your Defining Moments article. We started with it. And at the end of your essay, you reflect on the power of the diabetes community to mobilize and affect change to improve the lives of those with type 1. I'd like to close our interview by asking you to read a passage that serves as both a summary of your article and sort of an ode to your scholarly calling.
The diabetes community is mobilizing to make society more informed, less stigmatizing, and more accessible for future generations. There is power in numbers. Currently, there are several diabetes social movements about destigmatizing diabetes, getting emergency medicines to people in need, and providing better representation of people of color who have diabetes. I'm proud to be a part of the change.
Dr. Allison Hughes, thank you for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining Dr. Ali Hughes and I for this episode of the Defining Moments podcast. Defining Moments is produced by WOUB Public Media and the Barbara Geralds Institute for Storytelling and Social Impact. The Storytelling Institute imagines a world where storytelling creates just and joyful communities. Lynn Harder and I are our co-producers, and Colin Cameron is our audio engineer. You can subscribe to Defining Moments at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the NPR Podcast Directory. Please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at DMPodcastWOUB. On our Facebook page, we provide links to Dr. Hughes' Defining Moments article published in Health Communication. We hope you'll take time to rate and review this podcast. Thanks and be well.